Hi, I'm Susie Stadler, the Executive Director of At Home with Growing Older. Welcome to this first episode in our series on changemakers, people who have made and still make a difference in our lives by telling untold stories, thinking differently, and most of all, caring deeply for the well-being of others. In this first episode, we have put together the highlights of conversations we have had with three exceptional women: Katie Butler, Misty Gett-Smith, and Jenny Chin Hansen. They have made their mark in very different arenas, from empowering us to consider alternatives to a medicalized end of life, to revealing the special relationship to land that brings generations together in Black communities, to fighting poverty and improving the care for elders at home. We hope their personal stories and insights will inspire you in these transformative and challenging times.
At Home with Growing Older is a nonprofit organization which believes in peer learning and creating discussions which bring the lens of aging to a variety of topics. At Home with Growing Older is proud to be your host of At Home on Air, a radio hour offering connection, community, and knowledge to our participants remotely. Now, we invite you to listen and learn from this episode of At Home on Air.
People who are willing to contemplate their aging, vulnerability, and mortality often live better lives in old age and illness, and they experience better deaths than those who don't.
Our first featured changemaker empowers us to have agency until life's end. An award-winning New York Times Magazine journalist and thought leader in improving end-of-life care, Katie Butler has written two groundbreaking books, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death, and The Art of Dying Well. As an inspiring public speaker, she offers practical guidance for navigating the emotional and spiritual challenges of later life. Please enjoy this segment of our conversation with Katie from January 2022.
Well, I was already a journalist, and I already had critical thinking about institutions and systems. And then my father, who I just deeply, deeply loved, had a devastating stroke at the age of 79. And I was on the West Coast, and they were on the East Coast. And I ended up being part of that rollerboard generation where we are flying back and forth when our parents have health crises. I got very committed and involved with them. It was a long, painful decline. And 2 years after that stroke, he was given a pacemaker without any meaningful conversation about quality of life, family values, any of that. The fact that he was in this major, major painful decline. And I started to just see how technology has in some ways malformed our approaches to the end of life, and that we had such a hard time articulating what mattered to us with our doctors or having conversations over that great divide between medicine and medical language and ordinary life and ordinary language. He died after 7 years of a very slow decline, and I was just bewildered and I think angry that his end of life had been this painful and this poorly supported. I mean, it's ironic because a lot of money was spent, but in terms of the things that really could have been supported for him from medicine had been so lacking, so scarce. It sent me on this quest, I guess, essentially. And I ended up writing a New York Times Magazine article and then the book. It's been about 10 years of really contemplating. There's a couple things that I think are really important. One is understanding the hidden rules of the system of medicine. And this is something that if you're in medicine, this is like a no-brainer, of course. But if you're outside medicine, you really don't know this, which is as you decline, you will be offered just about any technological or chemical option that may possibly extend your life or may not, and may or may not interfere with your quality of life. But what you don't know if you're outside the system is that these things will keep being offered up and served up to you all the way to the ICU, and they will only stop when either you or someone in your family actually says, this is enough. Those of us in the lay public, we're often more concerned about our ability to enjoy life, our comfort, and our function than we are necessarily concerned with eking out the last extra week or 3 weeks or 3 months of life, at least theoretically. You know, maybe when we're faced with it, it's harder, yes. But at least now when we're not in the middle of crisis. So I think that question is something to ask a doctor, especially if you're feeling confused. What's the goal here? And then you can see if your goals are really in alignment. In the years I've spent listening to hundreds of people's stories of good and difficult declines and deaths, I've learned one thing. People who are willing to contemplate their aging, vulnerability, and mortality often live better lives in old age and illness, and they experience better deaths than those who don't. They keep shaping lives of comfort, joy, and meaning, even as their bodies decline. They get clear-eyed about the trajectory of their illnesses so they can plan. They regard their doctors as their consultants and not their bosses. They seek out medical allies who help them thrive, even in the face of disappointment and adversity, and they prepare for a good death. They tend to enroll in hospice earlier, and they often feel and function better, and sometimes they even live longer than those who pursue maximum treatment. They make peace with the coming of death, and they seize the time to forgive, to apologize, and to thank those they love. They rethink the meaning of hope, and they often die with less physical suffering and just as much attention to the sacred as our ancestors did. I guess I see that the pain we suffer when we lose people that we love or that we contemplate leaving our own lives, the pain we suffer is the other side of the coin to something that's the most beautiful about us, which is that we do have this capacity to love, and we do have this capacity for joy. Most of us are going to miss our lives in the moment of dying. It's not going to be easy to simply say, you know, I accept it, I let go. But a lot of people at the very, very ends of their lives do apparently let go and feel at peace. And that's also a beautiful thing.
One of the things I hear in my interviews with Black elders about their relationships to land is that land is a way of knitting people together in relationships of ongoing care and intergenerational obligation to each other.
Our second featured changemaker explores the deep connections between race, land, and kinship. Mistinget Smith founded the Black Land Project, which illuminates relationships between Black people, land, and place. She leads M. Smith Consulting, serving philanthropic and social sector organizations, and teaches in UVM's master's program in Leadership for Sustainability. Her compelling essays, poetry, and creative nonfiction appear in numerous publications. As a masterful speaker, she travels the country gathering Black people's stories. Here's a segment of our conversation with Mistinget from September 2023.
I started something called the Black Land Project about 12 years ago, entirely by accident. I was on a tour listening to people talk about their relationship to their land in a town in Alabama And I was with some other people, and we realized that the way that folks were describing their relationship to land didn't fall in any of the categories that we were used to thinking in. We thought, well, it would be agricultural, or it would be about property rights. But instead, people were self-defining their relationship to land in really different ways. And that boiled down to the place that nobody can tell me I have to get off of, the place where I get to belong and decide who belongs there with me. And as a result, I started listening to more people and asking people to share their stories with me about their relationship to land. One of the things I want to say about growing older as someone who grew up in a very traditionally African-American family and place is that eldering is not just the act of getting older. It's a responsibility. And one of the ways you fulfill that responsibility is to be able to thoughtfully communicate what you've learned from the choices you've made in your life. I started doing intergenerational Black land interviews a couple of years ago that came entirely out of trying to interview younger people and having them say, we are not interested in talking to you. We want to hear from our mother and our grandmother and our great aunt, and they don't ever tell us anything. So I was hearing from people in their 20s and their 30s and their 40s, how vital the stories elders in their communities are to their understanding of, like, literally where they stand, where they live. Why do we live in this neighborhood? Why does this neighborhood look like this? How long has Daddy owned that garage, and what was it before then? Those are really important stories. The Black Land Project is, after all, made up of stories. And one of the stories that affected me most profoundly was the story that was told to me by Ms. Virginia Hutchins of Flint, Michigan. She started out by saying, I do not care for the company of other people. And I thought, oh, this is not going to go well. But Mrs. Hutchins told me a story about being a very isolated and unhappy person for much of her life. And that when she finally got a home where she had a yard, a little front yard, she found happiness in growing flowers. Now, often when people think about Black relationships to land, they immediately go to gardening. But it is not the gardening that is the source of wisdom here. She loved her garden rather than people. She had photo albums full of photographs of her flowers. And her flowers eventually grew up the fence along the side of her house and kind of trellised themselves there. Her neighbors started to notice her flowers and ask her questions about her flowers. And she was kind of hesitant about it. But people then came to ask her advice about how to grow flowers against their own fence. And those became relationships. And she became trellised by those relationships. And so her house was broken into by a burglar who then set her house on fire. And she made a determination that she was not going to leave her home when the insurance company said that they wouldn't give her much money for it. And those neighbors who knew her only as the flower lady look out for her and make sure that she doesn't get run out of her home and that no one else victimizes her home, because that is her land, her place where she gets to stand, where no one can tell her that she needs to move. And for her, her relationship to land was about the creation of beauty, the creation of connection, and the creation of safety. So when we think about relationships to land as labor relationships or productive relationships, we sometimes forget these relationships to land. And for Black people who often have a history of having forced relationships to land, to choose to cultivate relationships of beauty and tradition and community are the essential definition of relationship. One of the things I hear in my interviews with Black elders about their relationships to land is that land is a way of knitting people together in relationships of ongoing care and intergenerational obligation to each other. And that has a historical tie. It comes directly to us from the Senegambia. It shows up in the US as something called heirs property, which is a way of passing down property, not to your immediate descendants, but to your descendants and their descendants collectively and indivisibly, so that caring for the land and the stories of the people on that land is actually what holds families and others in relationship with each other. There's an African-American spiritual that says, go into the wilderness, as a path for people to find spiritual clarity. One of the things I have learned through studying history and also listening to stories of Black people who live in uncultivated areas is that for Black people, what we call wildness, you know, the wilderness, is often places where Black people's residences hold the margin between what is wild and what is city or what is town. Black people often inhabit that margin. So what it means to be wild or to go out in the wilderness means something really different when you are actually the boundary between what is wild and what is not. And what I have found in listening to these stories is that relationships to land, including urban land, is a way of finding spiritual clarity, of being in the wild, even if the wild is in New York City.
Policy is very powerful, but policy by itself, if it's not implemented, doesn't mean a whole lot. It really takes the vision and then the hard work.
Our third featured changemaker champions improved older adult care through advocacy, policy change, and effective implementation. Jenny Chin Hansen's distinguished career includes serving as AARP president, CEO of the American Geriatric Society, and executive director of Unlock. She currently serves on the board of HelpAge USA and several advisory boards. Continuing her vital work as an advocate and thought leader in older adult care, here's a segment featuring Jenny from our third annual AGEN panel discussion in June 2022.
My fork in life that I recall is the whole question of staying in academia or going to the unknown. This opportunity to do something very different, to come up here to San Francisco. We were living in San Diego, and at that time, I think I was maybe 31, 32, I was a widow. I was on a faculty in a school of nursing. I'm a nurse by background. I was really bored with the whole issue of committee work and stuff. It was right around the time that students were also very fixated on their grades. So I'd have students who would argue with me over a two-point system, whether or not they got a certain score. And so that just didn't do it for me. I had a tenure-track position, and so that's something that's a little hard to come by, especially since at that time I still had only a master's degree. It was either the unknown, which is coming up here to San Francisco to do some research at Omlock Senior Health Services in San Francisco, or to stay in this faculty position where I get my summers off, I had a little child, and all of this. And so I just listened to my gut. I just needed something that had some more action, and being in academia just was not set up at the time for that kind of thing. So I basically got a U-Haul truck and took my four-year-old, and here we traipsed up to San Francisco, and the rest is history, I suppose. but I think it's taking a risk and jumping into the abyss. And the same thing here is I left OnLock after almost 25 years. People were surprised I left. They thought that I'd be there forever. But I once again knew that I was restless. And my dear husband, who's in the audience here, I shared with him a couple of years before I left. I said, you know, something's going on inside. I don't know what it is, but I don't think that I'm going to be staying, but I don't know. So when I jumped and left, I had nothing. And so this was one of the things that he wrote with me. He said, we'll do okay. The ability to take chances over something that your own soul is telling you, listening to that. And sometimes it's not like the 2-year plan, 5-year plan. No, you know, I'm a person who jumps. So anyway, but that's what happened. I spent nearly 25 years with the organization OnLock Senior Health Services in San Francisco, which really started from a community perspective of need and assessment and listening to what's important to have in a community for a healthy community. And having a chance to operate and lead the operations itself, but my parents benefited from it. My parents were immigrants and they were not wealthy. And the fact that the work that I was doing was something that they benefited from, as well as the community, as well as my brother. My brother had early Parkinson's and ended up being in our program. But to have this program that starts grounded in the community, moving to saying, this shouldn't be just in one place. Everybody faces this kind of issue. In general, this was for low-income populations, but middle-income, high-income, this is universal. People travel this journey. The question of replicating it and having a chance to test it out in other communities of color, in South Carolina, in Texas, and others, to have it start that way and become a federal law. The program operates now in 31 states. To realize that something can start from the community and change policy and affect so many people beyond the original population ourselves, to realize this is a universal life experience where people will have challenge. And so to have a hand in that and then to benefit it as a daughter, as a sister, and to learn and to be exposed to so much, I'm both proud of it and I'm grateful. My work history conveys this understanding that changing policy is real important. The policy of poverty, for example, making sure that people have a living wage, the living amount that is important to have a dignified life at any age. So the sense of communalness is important. Policy is very powerful, but policy by itself, if it's not implemented, doesn't mean a whole lot. It really takes the vision and then the hard work of thinking what would be good, say, making sure people had income, to making sure there are programs and money that follow that, and a way to implement that program. Now, just doing great work at the community, we touch certain lives, but then we know that that universal issue is bigger. And so in some ways, that's how I started. I started with community work. And then you realize this is not an unusual situation, that people needed good care as they got more frail. And then so you start looking up, like, where's the decision come from? So you go from the community level to policy. And then for those who make policy, making sure they understand that to pull that stuff off, you have a team of people, an infrastructure, and the sustainability to this. Advocacy is so crucial, but advocacy is only part of the ecosystem of making things happen so that it touches real lives. When it comes to thinking about the progress that we've made, the recognition of humanism and dignity in my public health work led me to think about older individuals. I've been in the field of aging and geriatrics almost all my career. So when you carry the torch for older people as one of the major isms that we still have now and more, I realized two things. One, that the desire to learn about the life course was not as enthusiastically embraced 50 years ago. But as people age, as our legislators age, as we have family caregiving responsibilities, as we recognize the factor of dementia, over 85. Easily 40% of us will be touched by this. So the content of age, health about it, has now taken greater interest because it affects not just policy, but our time, our money, our hopes and wishes for the future. So there's been a change, and it's because people have had that personal experiential component. So then our hearts are more open to this. Back to all these isms, for any of us in any of the categories we happen to be in right now that people designate, we've all felt some of this, whether it's formal aggression or whether it's been microaggressions. And part of it is we've all been at the receiving end of it, and maybe we've also been at the giving end of it. But the ability to think, when do you take steps to do something about it, is kind of forks in the road right now. And for those of us who've made it this far, we have been receipts of the isms quite a bit. There's all kinds of things. You just have to kind of understand and experience. But how we choose to respond to it and the timing of it, the context of it, is something that is a discernment that we all start to learn as to when you choose your battles or you choose your actions. And I think a lot of us have dealt with it. Part of it is not to let them accumulate so much that it creates a self-doubt, rather than recognizing sometimes it's just not worth it. You know, it's just there, and you realize everybody's going through some of this stuff. So how much you react to is a matter of timing and choice and the degree of what that experience might be. The fullness and humanism and the texture of what we have, there's slow progress, and I think it's beginning to grow, but it takes all of us to do that work.
This episode of At Home On Air was produced by the At Home with Growing Older team. We could not host these conversations without the generosity of our marvelous and passionate guests and hosts. Thank you for sharing your personal and professional insights. To subscribe to this podcast and for more information, visit us at homewithgrowingolder.org. At Home with Growing Older strives to educate, inspire, and connect people across generations and disciplines to re-envision and improve the experiences of later life. Don't forget to subscribe and tune in for the next episode.